Good morning, everyone. Louise is away. She happens to be in Arles right now. That would be France. So I am very fortunate to be joined by Ronalee McMahon of the Salmon Arm Fair and Desiree Roy, who is the co-convener of the A1 division. Welcome, ladies.
Hi.
It's nice to see you today.
Thanks, Tracy.
Yeah, I'm actually very thrilled because I'm the other co-convener of the A1 division. Desiree and I are working together this year, and we're excited because A1 division is the super fun part. Sorry, everything else doesn't really matter. It's only A1 division. That's why they've given us A1 as the designation, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All about you. Yeah.
That's right. Well, actually, it's not all about me. It's about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So first, before we get into some of the things we want to talk about the 2018 fair, let's talk about all the background stuff. Ronalee, I know you haven't been with the fair for 55 years or anything, but you certainly know a lot about fairs. So let's talk about the fair.
So thanks, Tracy. It's been a sharp learning curve, and the fair is 121 years old this year. So that's exciting. And I thought we could talk a little bit about what a fair is, maybe. So I've been digging around and thinking a lot about that. And I know to most people, an agricultural fair is exhibits, and it is, you know, baking and canning and livestock competitions, and it's a midway rides, and we have all of that and more, and it'll be a great, great fair this year. But I think it's also worth talking about the fact that for over a century, fairs have served as a major source, a major social and economic driver in their communities. So, you know, the recent research shows that they're contributing more than $13 million annually to the local economy. And, you know, they offer networking, they offer business development and agricultural education opportunities too, mm-hmm. which I think is a valuable contribution.
Well, especially now when we need to learn how to feed ourselves, right? Like on a local level, we better start learning now.
Exactly, yeah. So I do think they have a valuable role to play in community building and strengthening those partnerships within the agricultural industry, sharing best practices, and to your point, Tracy, raising the next generation of farmers, growers, and food producers, mm-hmm. because that is top of mind for a lot of people right now.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about the theme. So how does this tie in, though, like in terms of the fair's purpose in a community and the theme that was chosen by the board and there's kind of a couple different levels, right? There's the fair board and plus the conveners group and then if, you know, there's, yeah, lots of levels. So yep. It had to be a huge collaborative effort to come up with a theme for this year. So tell us about how the theme, what the theme is, and how the theme ties into the purpose of the fair.
Yeah, so I really believe, and I speak on behalf of the fair committee when I say this, is that the fairs need to reflect not only the diversity of the community, but they do need to create an interactive and an immersive experience for their visitors. So that looks way different than a passive experience. So mm-hmm. so they do that through programs and events and activities. So, you know, for me, you know, I think a fair visitor should be able, you know, not just to come and see knitting, but bring their needles and learn how to knit. Not just see canning, but learn how to can. And again, not just see the flowers, but learn to grow flowers. And when you talk about the arts, having an opportunity to come and draw or to participate in some way. So this year is the 121st anniversary. And I think it is a great opportunity to just showcase that.
And using
the one-to-one, yeah, to create that interactive, immersive experience. So this year's theme, Salmon Arm Fair, 1-to-1. Fun for everyone, is symbolic of the one-to-one interaction that is at the center of the 2018 fair.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It's hard for us to get our heads around 1-to-1, honestly, because, you know, Desiree and I are both visual people. So I think it might be difficult for a lot of people to make a visual display of that. However, interactivity isn't visual. It's very much about doing and communicating and trying stuff out. So that's really exciting. And it's exciting for us in the arts sector as well, because we believe that people should do stuff, right, to participate.
Yes, absolutely. I think hands-on, one-on-one learning, especially for artists and, you know, young people or older people too, it's nice to be able to work with someone and get those experiences from them.
Yeah, there's a lot of skills and knowledge out there, and we need opportunities for people to pass those skills on.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a lot of mentorship opportunities in Salmon Arm, apprenticeships, things like that. Like, it just seems to be one of those processes that seems to be disappearing. People just go to YouTube to learn things. And
yeah, definitely.
So this is a great opportunity for that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And to pass on knowledge from one generation to the next, too, I think is...
Yeah, I see that being, like, very valuable. And that's why I speak to the young people, right? Like, they get excited, very excited to come to the fair. And then to have these kind of one-on-one interactions available for them, they're going to be able to learn how to, you know, grow a tomato and then put a tomato into the show. I mean, that's what I did when I was a little girl.
Yeah.
I was really excited when I would grow my tomato plants and then bring my big tomato in and hopefully win.
Oh, nice.
Right?
So... Well, tell us about that experience. So you remember coming into the fair at a young age and, mm-hmm. and learning stuff and then being able to submit entries.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up out in Silver Creek, actually, and we had a couple acre farm. So my parents taught me how to do gardening, and, you know, we had our own plants and we would grow our own tomatoes, and then we would bring them in and kind of compare them to others' tomatoes, and we could learn from the other people. And, okay, how did you get your tomato so red? Or, you know, what kind of tomato is that? Like, what's the best kind of tomato to put in the show? And you sort of just get to learn about the whole agricultural process. And you get a sense of pride, too. And I see that in not only, like, the agricultural sector, but for young artists in terms of the A1 division, being able to, you know, see their artwork displayed.
Mm-hmm.
That's so important for young people to be able to do that and realize that there is a space for their artwork.
Yes. Yeah. There is
a space. It inspires them. It does. Mm-hmm. It's very inspiring. Yeah.
Well, one of the things, speaking of history, is when I first became involved with the fair, with the A1 division, I really had to look back and say, well, why does it even exist, right? You have to kind of figure out why you're there if you're going to participate in something. And it turns out that the domestic arts wasn't always part of the fair. It was completely agricultural, and there was livestock and, you know, things like that, and grain and hay bales. That was pretty much it, right? But the domestic arts is what kind of brought... women into the fair, and also recognize the work that was done over the winter. So the baking and the canning and the needlework and the knitting and, like, the textiles, all that stuff was the winter's, like, the evidence of everything that they did in the summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the work in the winter. So you grew sheep, so you got wool, and then you spun it into yarn, and then you made something. Or, you know, you dried or canned your fruits and you could produce this thing. So I just feel like that being the foundation for the arts division made me rethink how, like, what it had become over the last sort of 40 years and what I really wanted to imagine for it. And I think it's, yeah. And of course, textiles has become its own division in the decades. And I mean, baking and canning are their own divisions. Like, everything kind of has their own thing. So I had to kind of look at the visual arts like, what's our purpose here? And yeah, it was really interesting to kind of be able to focus on, okay, what did people do in the winter? What did they do to show, like, what did they have to show for their incredible spring, summer, fall work? And yeah, so that's kind of been a focus for what I think is happening in the A1 division.
So can you talk a little bit more about your purpose, Tracy? Like, you know, the purpose of your purpose, your division's purpose, as you see it?
Oh, sure. Well, in addition to recognizing the efforts of people who have diverse interests and skills, because that's something that I see a lot of in the agricultural industry too, that people have something else they do and something else they do really well. So I do like to make sure, and, you know, maybe it's part of being part of the gallery and the art center, that I have standards. I feel like if you're going to do something, it should be done well. It should be presented well. It should be clean and tidy and can hang or be displayed in a way that's, you know, that you can see the artwork for what it is rather than the scuffs on the frames or, like, that it's not mounted properly or framed properly or whatever. So I have kind of pushed that element over the last few years to make sure that this is your opportunity to show your best work of the year. So be proud of it and make sure it's presented well. And I've been pushing the framing, especially because we have pegboards to display the artwork on, and all we have are the little hooks that hook into the pegboard. So everything has to have a wire. So you can't just bring in a hunk of paper and say, look at this awesome paper thing I did. There's no way to show it off. And there's no way to give it that sort of space, that visual air that it needs to be appreciated. So the framing part's been a big part of what I'm doing. And then also the recognizing that people have changing interests and there's trends and things like that. And also that people like to do things as a family. So I've actually, in consultation with Desiree, we made some changes this year.
Some exciting ones, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's very exciting because it's recognizing that not everything is done by individuals. Mm-hmm. Lots of times families like to do things together, or brothers and sisters or friends or whatever, right? So we've taken some things out of the children, youth, and adult classes and put them into this kind of all ages family class. And yeah, recognizing that we can do fun stuff together too.
Yeah, and I think it really gives the opportunity for parents to make things with their children, or, you know, grandparents or whomever, to do things with their families and pass on knowledge that way. So it becomes this almost part of the theme, right? It becomes this one-to-one or family-to-one, or we're all just learning together to make something together. And that's huge, because that's how you retain that information.
Yes. And an age of screens and that kind of thing. Like, we need more opportunities for one-to-one, mm-hmm. and sometimes we need to be poked and pushed to do one-to-one. So
yeah,
it's a good opportunity for that.
Well said, Desiree, because those are powerful moments leading up to that, you know, up to that moment where you're actually submitting your exhibit. You know, there are those moments and learning moments in the home and, you know, time for family time.
Yeah. So make sure, and I just want to make my last point again. It's your best work, right? Like, this is your time to showcase. It's not about, do I get a prize? Do I get the $6 prize? Or do I get the $4 prize, right? It's not really about that. It's about showcasing your work. And one of the things that I recognize too is that there are more people seeing this exhibition, like, because I consider that the A1 division an exhibition, more people seeing it in one weekend than we have at the gallery in like 4 or 5 months of being open, right? So this is our opportunity to show our entire community breadth and depth of skill and talent and ability. So I want lots of participation. I don't want people to think, oh, I didn't really, you know, think that my... No, I don't care. Get it framed. If you're proud of it, that's good enough for me, man. If you're pleased with it, get it framed, bring it in, submit it. Because we want to showcase as many people's work as we can.
Absolutely.
We want to bust at the seams. Yeah. That's what we aim for.
And you know what? That's such a good personal practice to push yourself to, you know what? Oh, I really like this painting. I think this is cool. You know what? Do it. You have the self-confidence. You can get your work out there and you can get it seen by, you know, hundreds of people.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised how many people will read the tiny font on the label and say, I know that. And then they find you later and say, oh my gosh, I saw your painting at the fair. It was so cool. It's so nice to hear that, to hear all these random different people that, you know, maybe you don't see very often tell you that they've seen your thing, right? Your prize onions, your knitted socks, whatever, that they've seen your thing and congratulations on your third place ribbon. It's really nice. So you do kind of recognize that lots of people see this work, and it's important. It's important to put yourself out there.
Yeah. And I think we're pushing the boundaries now on community a little bit. You know, our reach is further than it was even 5 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, traditionally, you know, community would gather in their local halls, and now we're seeing, you know, less halls. So
yeah,
the fair is becoming even more important for a place for people to gather and to show.
Exactly. And I think that is one of the things that I keep in mind at the Art Center all the time in terms of programming. What am I doing to make sure that there's opportunities to gather, opportunities to meet new people, to talk about important things, and to not have, not have restrictions and, you know, like, well, ticketed things and, right? Like, things like that, where it's a real open, accessible event. So I'm always thinking about that. So let's talk about how the fair does that, and traditionally and for this year. Like, what kind of things we have planned for this year that will do that?
Of course, I don't have the history to talk too far back. But again, you know, being interactive, creating that immersive experience really is at the center of the 2018 fair. So, you know, really going deep to say, well, what does that mean? You know, well, that means, you know, setting up a tent where, you know, community can gather and at different times they can, you know, hear from, you know, topic specialists or, you know, they can learn to raise healthy chickens. And from there, you know, goes a whole other conversation. But it is creating that environment where people can come together. They can have those meaningful conversations with old friends, meet new friends. So that's the environment that we're for sure hoping to create this year. And I think, Tracy, it's something as simple as the Lego play pit, you know, where our convener, who is just awesome, Daryl, is doing just that. You know, he's putting the Lego out. It's a play pit where, you know, families can gather and, you know, friends can come together and they just create things for a certain amount of time. But basically, you know, it's over when it's over. And
Well, and it's just the opportunity to do it. If you want to do it for 10 minutes or 2 hours, if you've got that ability, if that's what your kid or that's what your grandma is really interested in, you can just do it.
You can just do it with her or do it with him or, you know.
Yeah.
For sure. So anyways, so I'd like to hear more about what you're doing.
Well, Desiree and I have an idea. I know. What we're going to do. Now, one of the things that I added to the list of classes a couple of years ago is the artist trading cards. So if you don't know what that is, artist trading cards were started back in the early 90s as a mail art idea, and they're the same size as baseball cards or hockey cards, except they're all original works of art. So there's no photocopying or, you know, copying of any kind involved. Artists make them. They're 2.5 by 3.5 inches. They are made from everything from collage and paintings and drawings to photographs, fabric, clay. Like, I've seen just all kinds of mixed media cards. They're amazing. And people just trade them one-to-one. Like, talk about the one-to-one idea, right?
Yes.
Cards are not worth a single dollar. They are not. They don't have any cash value. Apparently, Yoko Ono is an artist trading card creator. Mm. Even a Yoko Ono card is only worth one of my cards. You know what I mean? Like, it's just clear up trade, free art. But you have to make art too. So I started doing this way back, like, you know, 12, 15 years ago, because it was a creative opportunity for people of all ages and all abilities of all media, right? You can just kind of sit down with some collage materials and glue sticks and you're good to go. So I've done it in workshops. I've done it for kids at school tours. I went into the schools to do it during art fair at the Piccadilly Mall. Like, I've been just kind of, you know, artist trading card crazy for quite a few years. So I decided to do a category in A1 Division 3 years ago for traders. And it was great. And we decided to do a trade at the end of the fair last year, which was very challenging at 5 o'clock when it's like the floor of the stock market and everybody's trying to get their work, right? So we decided that this year, this is Desiree. I'm so happy to have Desiree on because we had this conversation about how this would look. Having an opportunity to make cards during the weekend and then have an open trade at 4:30 during the fair, right there at the A1 division, would mean that people that made cards during the weekend or people that entered cards into the fair would be able to trade with each other. So that's our big plan.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to get in there and make some cards myself, too. So,
yeah, I'm thinking I have to carve out the time, too.
And it's fast and easy. Like, they're so fast. You can, and like, I have a huge artist trading card collection, and the whole thing fits in a binder like that. And like 2 inches thick, right? So I feel like that's the best way to collect art. It fits on my bookshelf. And your materials can be anything. Like, collage materials can be candy wrappers and stamps and, right? Like, it's just stuff that you're recycling and repurposing. So it's an excellent upcycling art media.
And it's open to all ages.
Yes, everybody can do it. And they look awesome when they're done because they're tidy and cute.
Yeah.
I could have a whole show about artist trading cards. And there's mail trades still happening all over the world. Like, you can send a There's a page that you can buy at the dollar store that's got 9 little plastic sleeves, and you stick 9 cards in and mail it away to somebody. And there's a mail in, or there's a trade in Chicago every year, twice a year, and there's one in Calgary, and they're all over the place. And so you just send your cards in, and then they all get shuffled together, and then somebody stuffs your sleeve back with other people's cards and sends it back to you. So you get cards from all over the place.
So are you telling me that I might be able to get a Yoko Ono card still?
You might be able to.
Because that would be very interesting.
Would that not be the bomb? Is yes. To get like get this trade back?
Yeah.
I'd be pretty chilled. I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Wow, so that's very exciting. And new to me. I don't have this history. So this is great. This is the first I've heard of them. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. Well, I did think, like, I feel like it's one of those great, easy access, like open to everybody, no matter what you do kind of projects. So that's why I keep doing it. And it might have been a bit of a fad because it was like a European thing for a while in the 90s and everybody was doing it. Now, not so many people do it. There's just a few diehards out there, but I still think it's an awesome one-to-one opportunity.
But I think that's like any kind of collecting, whether it's ball cards or, you know, stamps, like there are people who are right into that. So this is sort of one of those niches where people can get really into it. So I think it's awesome to offer up that opportunity to people. If they mm-hmm. find this to be something that they are passionate about, they have the opportunity to become involved in that community. So,
yeah. And it is a community, worldwide community. You get to know people. I was contacted by a woman who got my card in San Francisco, and she just sent me an email just to say, hey, I like your card. If you ever want to do another trade, you know, just keep me in mind. Yeah, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her last name was Zombie, which was interesting.
Wow.
I know.
Wow. Look at that. She might even get a new friend out of the deal.
Exactly.
You never know.
Which is what it's all about, yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. Let's expand our horizons. And then, nice. So that's just a one division. So that's one interactive thing that we're going to do this year. We're pretty excited about. But
so people bring their creativity. Are there other things that they bring? Do they bring materials from home?
Well, they can if they want, but we're going to have like a ton of stuff mm-hmm. there because nice. That's the one thing that we are very pleased with is that we're very thrifty at the Art Center and we keep stuff.
Yeah. So
we have lots of stuff.
You can come check out our closet.
Oh my gosh. Actually, don't come check out
just
our
kidding.
Closet. That would be a bad idea. People that come and look at our supply cupboard, they're like, whoa, you guys keep everything.
Well, you never know.
Exactly. I feel like that. So it's, yeah. So for us, it's going to be fun. We've kind of scheduled a Saturday and Sunday session between 11 and 2, I think. But it might be like 10 to 1. I kind of feel like the opportunity is there to share space with people and not just have a dedicated space just for us, but to have an ever-rotating event. So that might be something that happens, right?
Yeah. And, you know, bringing cookies or bringing cupcakes in and, you know, having the icing there and just letting, you know, and it doesn't need to be kids, just letting anybody decorate and is another great way to build on that space or to use that space for sure. So,
and even for learning opportunities, I don't know what the regulations are about backyard chickens in Salmon Arm, but I know so many people who would deeply desire to learn how to have like a backyard beehive or backyard chickens or something like that. If there's a way that they can learn to do small scale agriculture in an urban environment, you know, there's just so many people that want to learn about that. So even if those interactive tables or tents or whatever are given a schedule where people can sign up to learn how to keep a hen house with 4 hens, how to collect eggs, how to set it up, you know, like the basic information that we've kind of lost because we're not growing up on farms.
Yeah. And it's interesting how many young people, I say young people, then I have to sort of put myself into that group, not the young person, just the person that has never seen, you know, the green egg versus the, you know, the white egg versus, and, you know, in conversations with poultry, they said, you know, well, why not, you know, bring eggs that the kids can, and not, again, not just kids, but, you know, that they can decorate and, you know, increase their knowledge a little bit on what poultry is all about. So,
yeah.
So again, another good use of the space for sure.
Yeah. I hope there's going to be an opportunity for bees, for hives. or it, not even honeybee hives, but for opportunities for creating space for bees? Because I know there's a lot of, you can, ooh, that's actually a category we added to A1 division is bird, bees, and bat houses.
Right.
Yeah, made out of natural materials only.
Really important, yeah.
Yeah. So learning about how to help the bee population would be so critical. Like I just watched my neighbor out there with a spray gun spraying his dandelions with something. And I'm thinking, why are we still doing that? Like, why doesn't everybody know to leave the dandelions alone? Like, why? And it's just education. We just need to reach everybody in every opportunity we can get to help them understand their role, right? Their role in the world and in agriculture. And, you know, if we have urban landscapes poisoning their flowers or poisoning their what they deem as weeds, but are really just, you know, natural plants, that's harming agriculture in our area because then we're decimating the bee population. So,
and we're affecting things that we don't even understand when we're doing things like that. Not to mention, you can actually use dandelions. The entire plant is edible. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know that in Europe you can buy like little packages of dandelion seeds?
Yeah. Little, that's fantastic.
Yeah, little picture of a dandelion on the front. Like, oh my gosh. Here you'd be, But no, because they make dandelion wine, of course, over there and eat the greens. And so it's like a crop.
Yeah.
Can just, which I usually have a very nice crop in my yard anyway, which I'm sure, you know, my uneducated neighbors might think is really terrible. But for me, I'm like, nope, I see bees. So I'm happy.
Well, what about the bees? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Keep that population healthy. And I mean, whether that means at the fair, putting some information out there about what kinds of flowers bees do well with and, you know, having those in a place where, you know, there isn't a huge, you know, walking traffic or something, but having those in an area so that we're being conscious of that.
Mm-hmm. And making sure you have water sources
mm-hmm.
because bees need water, just like butterflies and, you know, all the other little critters that are pollinators. They need water. And so, yeah, people need to learn that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And where else are they going to learn it if they're not inclined necessarily to look it up or to, you know, consult their Encyclopedia Britannica about things? It's when you've got them, right? When you've got them in person at some place like the fair. If their kid is busy playing Lego and your how to attract bees to your yard table is right next door, that's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent opportunity, yes. Yeah. And I have been having those conversations, and there is a ton of knowledge in this area when it comes to our bees that needs to be shared.
Yes.
And people that want to learn. So I think the fair is a great place to bring that all together for sure. So we'll be doing that. Because I think, you know, having that observatory where you can see the bees is important. Mm-hmm. Having that knowledge and being able to take it away and apply it.
Yeah.
Is the work of the fair this year for sure.
Yeah. Fantastic. It's a little ways off from the fair, but we have to start thinking about the fair because we're planting things, and things that are planted now might produce the biggest something that you want to enter into the fair. So it's time to think about it. Get busy thinking about the fair. Before the break, we were talking about all the different things you can learn while going to the fair. We were really very passionate about learning how to make artist trading cards, but also about how to take care of our planet and make sure that we have a good urban growing environment so that we're also helping to support the larger agricultural growing environment. And talking about bees and stuff like that. But I'm now kind of wondering, like, other learning opportunities, other ways that we can, because I kind of feel like, you know, I have a very unusual upbringing. I grew up in Toronto and then we moved out west where I lived in a very small town, smaller than this room. And it was agricultural by nature. And so I was, as a teenager, kind of thrown into this, you know, hayfield situation and not really understanding what was what and how things worked. All I knew is that most of the boys that I knew were already driving combines. So that was unusual. And yeah, I kind of feel like I missed out on that understanding of how farms really work, especially big farms, family farms, like how everybody has to pull together. So some of the fall fair experiences I've had have been about, you know, learning about 4-H and what they do and how kids have, have livestock from babies to grownups and how they manage that. And right, like that's kind of part of what I've experienced as a urbanite arriving in the West. Yeah. So is there, I'm sure there's continuing to be more of those kinds of things, more of those experiences for this year.
Mm-hmm. And 4-H does have a very, very important role to play in the fair, not just an important role, they have a large role to play in the fair. So it's good. I mean, you know, this year the beef is back, so and poultry's back. So it is an opportunity to learn more about, you know, some of the rarest of chickens. And it is an opportunity to feed the poultry and to have those conversations with people that are knowledgeable, like our 4-H leaders are. So again, you know, that topic was, you know, the center of our conversation with our conveners at the last meeting was, you know, how are we going to get creative about sharing that knowledge, mm-hmm. and make this a really immersive experience. And 4-H has a big role to play in that, yeah. Tracy.
And the poultry issue, like, maybe people didn't realize that birds were taken out of the fair for a lot of years after the bird flu situation, right? It was just kind of deemed best to not have them. And so there used to be opportunities to see all these fancy chickens and pet them even, right? And then for so many years, they were just not part of the fair. But now they're back.
And this year it's a rabbit. So, you know, sadly, unless that's lifted, we won't see rabbits this year.
Oh,
because
what happened
of
to
a
bunnies?
Condition with them this year, a health condition with them. So
oh.
I can't just rhyme the name of the virus off, unfortunately, but it doesn't look hopeful for bunnies this year. But we'll have chicks, you know, baby chicks that they can hold. And the SPCA, I mean, a little off the topic of agriculture, but they'll be there, you know, with some of their little critters. So sharing their knowledge, which is very valuable. And, you know, people have an opportunity to ask questions about their pets and to hold the, you know, the smaller animals. So so that'll be good for our fairgoers, for sure.
I think that's cool for people, especially to be able to see these rescue, just to know that there's these rescue animals are available for adoption as well, right? So,
mm-hmm. But talk about hands-on. I mean, I don't know. In this world of liability insurance, there's not a lot of opportunities to touch things.
Mm.
So just the fair being willing to be that opportunity to pick up a chick and hold a chick. That's really good.
Yeah, that is. It is great. And, you know, and to see how, you know, how we shear our sheep, you know, we have somebody that, you know, for health reasons wasn't able to join us last year, and he's healthy this year. So, you know, he'll be back at the fair and he'll be doing some sheep shearing. So that's a huge attraction, you know, and another wonderful learning opportunity.
I know, I remember the crowd gathers around the sheep shearing situation. And so as a, you know, you're walking by and you're going, what's going on? What's going on? You have to dig your way through, elbows up, to try to figure out. And it's just some guy shearing sheep. You're like, why is everybody so fascinated? But it is kind of cool to watch, and it's a little bit alarming, but that's okay. I'm not used to that.
I think as much as we live in a smaller town and an agricultural, somewhat agricultural town, there are urbanites here too who don't know what a real sheep looks like. So like being able to see a real sheep or see a real cow or to see something and actually understand their role or to understand what they look like alive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's huge.
When they're alive.
Yeah.
You're right, though. And then the spinners and weavers used to do a sheep to shawl competition, and they still do sheep to shawl, but it's just, there's a few steps in between that have to have been taken out because it's just too crazy. And believe me, now that we're doing a little lake project with the felting, oh man, I'm totally, like, I don't know why real yarn, like wool, isn't worth like $50 a meter. The work that goes into making what happens when you look at a sheep run by to the point where you're knitting a sock, ugh, it's just unbelievable the work that's involved with that.
Pretty labor intensive for sure.
Yeah.
But when you talk about sheep to shawl, they've got 5 teams competing this year. So that's great for the Saturday. And they're offering some needle felt, so a small take-home item that...
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you can learn how to weave on a loom. So... and then you can also take part in, and I saw it at Heritage Week at the Piccadilly Mall, you can take part in blanket walking. Have you seen that done?
No.
So that event is being hosted Friday at 4:00, and you push and you pull and you crunch and this gigantic wet woolen blanket. So everybody circles around this big wet woolen blanket, and you toss this blanket between you in this circle. And then eventually,
Desiree and I are like, what?
And they do this in song, and I hope that they'll do that at the fair. And then later this blanket is, it's cut apart, and it's brushed to raise the pile and making it all warm. And it's just a fabulous...
What? And that is such an interesting tradition.
It is a very interesting tradition. So,
well, now I really want to see what that's all about.
Yeah,
that
me too.
Bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah, so it'll be a great thing for fair visitors to take part in, for sure.
Yeah,
so.
Well, the spinners and weavers section is always a blast anyway. Like, I just love going through there, and when they're actually doing the spinning, especially. Like, the loom work is, like, I've seen that before, but the spinning is just mesmerizing. And they have to know exactly how many fibers are going, right? Like, it just seems like another thing that seems way too laborious for me to participate in, but it's great to watch.
But yeah. And that's a lot of the things, right? Like, canning isn't just you put stuff in a can and make it happen. Like, there's a labor to it, and I think that for a lot of people, that's a labor of love. And being able to learn about those things gives you the opportunity to be able to learn those things and to take them in for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, to be able to know how to know that you know how to do something like that. That's huge.
And I think that's something that's important to know, is that things have changed over the years, that maybe the way your grandmother canned things doesn't have to be the way you can things. Mm. And I've learned different canning techniques over the years that turns out, you know, works perfectly fine. Like, we actually we haven't lately, but for a few years we canned peaches with honey, and there's a method to do that that's actually fairly straightforward, and so no sugar is involved. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't can for a lot of years, because I'm anti white sugar, right? And so there's lots of things to learn out there that are different ways to do things.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. I made some jam a couple of years ago, and instead of using pectin, I used chia seeds to thicken. Yeah.
Very nice.
So you're getting a lot of different vitamins and nutrients in that as well. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Chia seeds are like little miracles. Chia pudding. Super awesome. Oh, it makes me hungry.
Yeah.
Okay. I know. They go really good in your shake in the morning, for sure.
Yeah. And then, so speaking of canning, that's because that's an important skill, not just canning, but preserving food. So even dehydrating and freezing, there's techniques to all of those things. But speaking of that, there's no convener for the canning division. Is that right?
That's right. So we're on a search. We're on a search for a canning convener. We've been very, very fortunate to have, not the least of which is you, long-standing conveners. But that position is open this year. So it has in the past been done by the baking convener, but this year we'll be looking for a canning convener. So
if anybody out there has some knowledge about canning, this is a great opportunity to, I mean, you don't have to be an expert. It's kind of nice to know some things, but it's a great opportunity to learn, to work with a team, to create a beautiful display, to figure out, you know, standards, to learn about trends, what's happening in the world, and then be able to share the knowledge.
And I think the co-convening, so, you know, with you and Desiree, I think this is another wonderful opportunity to co-convene and to share your knowledge and your education. You know, if you can have somebody at your table, and then you can have somebody in the tent doing a canning demonstration or talking about, you know, how to freeze or preserve food. Mm. You can do that when you're part of a team,
right?
Whether that team is two or whether that team is three or four. But
my personal, because Carmen Moore used to be my co-convener, my personal preference is to always have a team member, like always have a partnership, because you just can't, you get inside your own head and you just think, yeah, and you just bulldoze ahead. But you need to have conversations about things. And especially when you're talking about being creative with your division, everybody's responsible for a display. And if you don't kind of have a little bit of a conversation about display and presenting your division to the best of its ability, you know, you're not doing a service to the people who have exhibited, right? And you're not doing a service to the visitor either. you want to make sure the presentation is engaging to visitors. And there are a lot of talented conveners that the fair has right now that are spectacular display creators. So I think that's another reason to make sure that you have people on your team that all have different skills. So you don't have to do it alone. I would recommend not doing it alone, not being a by yourself convener.
Yeah. And as someone who's come on new this year, I would just like to say that I've had like a really good time. I feel like I'm learning so much about my community, and recently moving back to Salmon, I'm like, I grew up here, and then coming back as someone who's, you know, come back intentionally and chosenly. It's so fun to start to get involved with your community and to learn about all these passionate people. So I would just really, I would suggest it. It's been really fun so far. So,
oh, that's good. Look, and we haven't scared her away.
No, not at all. I think this is awesome.
Yay.
Yeah. And diversity of perspective, it is important, and how we build on one another's ideas, you know, and that diversity can come a number of ways. It can come by, you know, gender, it can come by age, it can come by experience, thought, whatever that looks like. But
yeah, well, I know we only have a minute left before we have to take a break, but let's talk quickly about age.
My age?
No, your age? I think the general age of the people who are organizing and doing the work of the fair. There is the same issue that is across the board in all the nonprofits, that there is a certain demographic that has traditionally been the go-getters, the everythings, and there's been some challenges pulling in the Gen Xers and the Gen Y and the Gen whatever's coming after and the millennials and everything. And so this is the time. This is the time to step up and say, yeah, you know what? I'm interested. I'm keen. Maybe I don't have a lot of time to give, but I want to learn how I can fit into this kind of situation. And I know there's a lot of people Desiree's age and younger and a little bit older who they are interested. They want to help. It's just being able to give them the space where they can do that.
Yeah. Having it be something accessible. Mm-hmm. That's huge.
Yeah. And now,
as the art world turns, a dramatic moment in the arts.
You guys are laughing at me. Why?
That was so cute.
There's a lot of drama in the art world.
Bracing myself for drama.
Well, there's always drama in the art world. Louise and I have never a problem trying to find a dramatic moment in the arts every week. Holy. So in case you follow the news, I'm just going to assume that you guys already know about the National Gallery of Canada's Chagall incident, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, it's just of interest to me because, you know, I'm in that sector, but probably to a lot of people because it is our national gallery, right? We should all know about what's going on there. So there was an incident. It turns out that Mark Mayer, the executive director of the National Gallery of Canada, was working to sell a Chagall painting. It was called La Tour Eiffel. So it's a lovely reddish painting of the Eiffel Tower and an awesome Chagall, selling it and with an expected income of about $9 million at Christie's in New York. And the point of selling the Chagall would be so that they could raise funds to purchase the painting St. Jerome Hears the Trumpet of the Last Judgment by Jacques-Louis David. And that is owned by the Notre Dame de Quebec Parish Corporation in Quebec City. And so there was kind of a feeling that there was a possibility that that piece would leave Canada if it was available for sale, and there were people interested in it. And if it got sold to a foreign buyer, then that would be it, right? It'd be lost to Canada. So here goes, the ED of the National Gallery selling the Chagall in order to buy this Quebec painting, saying it's part of our history. And then the you know what hit the fan.
Oh.
People didn't like the idea of selling the Chagall. And then it turned out that the painting in question was deemed to be of important historic value to Quebec. And so the Quebec provincial government, I think the provincial government, the Ministry of Culture, blocked the sale of it. So it's like, okay, now it's going to stay in Canada. But now, with a lot of public pressure, the National Gallery had to back off selling the Chagall, and now they're being charged basically $1 million for pulling it from the Christie's auction. So it's just kind of opened up this horrific can of worms about the process and the, you know, how everything works at the National Gallery, how we manage our national collection, how things are bought and sold, what things are of historic value, what things are important to keep in Canada, what things aren't important to keep in Canada, just how the whole process works, right? So that's been the big drama in the art world recently is what is going on at the National Gallery. Right? Like, where's the public consultation and that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think it is important to keep, you know, national pieces within the country if, you know, if they're of value and historically.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And, but it kind of, I mean, who gets to make those decisions, right?
Yeah.
And to be honest, I mean, there was huge staff cuts at the National Gallery, 2010, 2011, 2013, enormous staff cuts there. A complete restructuring of the National Gallery. So there was like 29 positions eliminated.
Wow, so it's a pretty small amount of people making these choices.
Yes, yeah. Which makes it very challenging because how do you assess, I mean, they've got a massive collection. How do you assess your sort of ongoing needs that your country needs, right? Public assessment. How are you interacting with the public? How is the public interacting and understanding and accessing the collection? How are you diversifying the voices of the collection? How are you keeping in touch with the rest of the world and looking for opportunities to bring in pieces that are important to the collection, important to Canada and to Canadians? So, I mean, how do you do that with a teeny weeny little staff that can barely keep the place open, right?
Yeah, no, you definitely need more public outreach in those situations.
Yeah. So I think that's been a big takeaway from this little situation is that they need to roll out a communication strategy and make sure that they're talking with the people of Canada. They represent us. And that the asset of our National Gallery's collection is all of our, you know, it belongs to all of us. And we want it to be not only managed properly, but we want it to be expanded in a thoughtful, meaningful way, especially in this time of reconciliation. We need to be very thoughtful about where we put our resources. And yeah, it's time for some significant public consultation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how do you give people a voice in that process, in that consultation process?
Yeah, that's a challenge because we can all say, oh, you need public consultation, but we know what town halls turn into.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a couple of loud people that get to just take over. So what does that even look like? What does communications look like in this age, right? Especially when we're talking about art too, which is so subjective. It's so difficult. Somebody can say that's important because historically it was this. The other person's like, no, it's not because there's this and then there's that. And I mean, you just have opinions all over the map.
Yeah. Coming to some kind of consensus would be really nice, whether that's possible or not.
Yeah. But being transparent to the public is also really critical. So even if it's not an entirely effective communication strategy,
yeah,
transparency is so important.
Especially when you're making those big kind of decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, that's the drama.
Yeah, that is drama.
I know, right?
It's interesting drama.
Well, I always find that kind of stuff is. I went to, it's, you know, I go to the National Gallery once every 15 years. Mm-hmm. I just happened to go last year, which was very exciting because I saw the Alex Janvier exhibition. I was blown away. And they were just in the middle of setting up for the big Canada 150 exhibition. So I didn't get to see that one. But even seeing Alex Janvier was like, you know, jaw-dropping, life-changing kind of stuff. But I also really enjoy being able to see the kind of public engagement projects that they do there because they have school tours and stuff going on all the time. So I get to poke in and see what they're doing with the kids and, you know, how they're interacting with the public at the, you know, at the front, like how they present their exhibition so that I can take that information and take it back to our teeny weeny little gallery to do similar things. So, yeah, so it's all important to me. So, yeah. How does that relate to the fair?
I think it does, though, Tracy. I think it does, listening, you know, to you talk. You know, similarly, I have been working with the local media to put a survey out and, you know, even to be bold enough to say, you know, share your age with us. You know, we want to know what the younger demographic is thinking compared to our more mature, you know, seasoned community members. And it's been insightful. It's been a really, really engaging process. So, you know, stopping in and, you know, seeing what your, you know, local business owner has to say about the fair, or what, you know, his or her vision might be for a certain, you know, division or section of the fair even. Mm-hmm. Those are valuable conversations to have, and then to be able to take it back to the board or to take it back to the fair committee and, you know, begin to shape that next experience. So being the 2018 experience, I think it's critical to success. I think it is how you build community and nurture community.
And if you really want a voice, just show up, right? Get involved, get on the committee, go to meetings. I know it sounds boring, but that's the way.
But it's not boring if you have a vision too, and you want to make an impact, and you want your fellow people to be out there with you. So I think that it doesn't have to be boring, and I think that's a misconception in a lot of ways, that it has to be boring, because it doesn't have to
be boring. No. Well, meetings don't have to be boring. There's lots of innovative ways to have meetings, but you still have to meet to have conversations.
Yes. And you can get a lot from those conversations. And I definitely see like getting more people on the board with diverse perspectives and opinions would be awesome, you know?
And some of the, you know, some of the fairs, the BC fairs, have what they call a junior board. So Port Alberni, for example, they're doing a fabulous, fabulous job. They're really leading the way. And they have a junior board, you know, that helps to guide the, you know, more seasoned board a little bit. And they bring a perspective and insights that the long-term board members don't necessarily bring.
Right. So absolutely necessary.
It's valuable.
Yeah.
And you know, fairs that aren't doing that, frankly, are, you know, they're one layer deep. We all need succession plans. We can all do better. Yes.
That's desperately needed.
And speaking to what we were talking about before, passing information down, being able to learn from our seasoned people, right? That's important.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing worse than having one person just completely step away and you have to find a replacement who doesn't even have the opportunity to learn from the person before them. You need some history. You need some kind of, you know, background. And otherwise, you have that organizational amnesia, and it's not fun because you make mistakes that have been made before.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, some mistakes are fun, but some are not.
No.
Some are a waste of resources. So, yeah, this is the time to be involved while everybody's still here and doing stuff. Yeah. Okay. We're just about at the end. So I just want to thank you two so much for coming and talking about this. For more fair information, you can reach all fair stuff on the website, salmonarmfair.com, correct?
Correct.
And the time for registering for being an exhibitor comes up in early August, correct?
It does come up in early August, and we're online now, Tracy. So that was popular last year, and I'm sure we'll see an uptick in it this year too. So
excellent. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Tracy, for having me. It was fun.
It was great. Desiree, good to be in your company. It was nice.
Thank you guys for having me.
Well, and thank you, Desiree, for being involved, because I think that we're kind of like a shining example of how to pass on information and to make sure that we have diverse voices, right?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Yay. Thanks, guys. Okay, I have a few little announcements to make. First of all, I wanted to point out that this is not just because my daughter is in the production, but the Sullivan acting class is putting on a Midsummer's Night Dream midterm at the Sullivan Theater. And if you're listening live right now, Friday, may the 4th be with you, then this is the last night. The show is at 6:30, doors open at 6. I saw it last night. So fabulous. I'm so delighted with it. They did an amazing job. So I highly recommend. Tickets are at the door. Just go to Sullivan Theater around 6 o'clock. You can get tickets. And then on the theater topic, ShoeSwap Theater is celebrating the merry month of May by giving away 5 pairs of tickets for their current production of Perfect Pie, which Desiree and I both saw last weekend, which is pretty amazing as well.
Absolutely.
I thought it was going to be very traumatic. I was kind of warned that it was going to be deep, but there was some funny moments. There were poignant. Oh my gosh, it was really beautifully done. And those young actresses were top notch. So they're having a giveaway. All you have to do is go to ShoeSwap Theater's Facebook page and enter by basically guessing a number. Choose a number between 1 and 25. Post your number along with the date of your desired performance in the comment box. And then the first 5 entries to guess the winning numbers, one of the winning numbers, will receive 2 tickets for the play, which will be waiting for you at the door. So you have to use Facebook. If you're not on Facebook, go to your friend's house, use Facebook, get on there and just pick a number between 1 and 25. So you could be seeing Perfect Pie with your friend. And do you know what they did at the halftime? They served pie.
They did.
You could get pie at Perfect Pie. I mean, you know, of course you can. So the play runs until May 12th. It is rated 14 plus, but not to be missed. It is it is their entry into the Ozone Festival. So, of course, they liked the big, powerful dramas, and that's one of them. It's pretty great. More info for that particular production at shoeshoptheater.com. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, ladies, again. And we wish you all a happy fair. Get growing, get making, and get showing. See you next time.
Enjoy the sunshine.
Yeah, thanks.